For people who love poetry, April is a month-long party. National Poetry Month is the one time of the year when Americans just flat out celebrate poetry. Local poets give readings and people show up. Schools and libraries, bookstores, coffee shops host poetry events. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this morning we are making the case for the importance of poetry in daily life. And not just every April, but year-round. We're talking with two of Wisconsin's chief poetry proselytizers. From our Eau Claire Bureau, the brand new Poet Laureate of Wisconsin, Max Garland. Welcome, Max. Congratulations on the new post.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. And in our Milwaukee Bureau, writer, UWM professor, and creator of the Poetry Everywhere Project, Liam Callanan. And Liam, thank you for being with us today.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you both. Well, so I'm curious, have the two of you done anything special for National Poetry Month? Max?
I have been traveling. I've been getting to know the roads of Wisconsin better than I even had before. I've been traveling a lot, visiting a lot of libraries, book festivals, and even writing some poems. But yeah, I've been getting around and talking about poetry quite a bit.
I was going to ask, I figure being Poet Laureate, I know there's a lot of traveling and a lot of presenting you do. The irony may be it's harder for you to actually write poetry.
That is sort of ironic. Back when I was a mail carrier for many, many years, did other sorts of jobs, I used to think about, well, wouldn't it be better to be teaching poetry and be sort of have a more integrated life? But it's oddly ironic that sometimes when you teach it and talk about it, and that's actually what you're supposed to be doing, you also have a little trouble finding time for it.
The life of a mail carrier might be better suited to being a poet.
Well, the one thing it left me with is the ability to get up very, very early. So that helps.
Liam, how about you? Done anything special for National Poetry Month?
I'm wearing a pale blue tie today, so I'm dressed up for Poetry Month. I also have been I've been going out to eat a lot because we here in Milwaukee and some locations in Madison are celebrating National Poetry Month with a program called Eat Local, Read Local, where we have local poets in local-centric restaurants, and they distribute little poem cards with your bill, and that way you can – it's just a wonderful treat at the end of the meal. So it's been really fun to go around to the restaurants and pick up a poem and collect all the eight cards and kind of just celebrate the month that way.
And these are all local poets? So it's not just Robert Frost with your soup and sandwich. It's somebody who could live in your own city?
Exactly. So in Milwaukee, it's a mix of Milwaukee and Madison poets because those are two locations. But I definitely look forward to, hopefully someday expanding the statewide because I think it's a really fun program. I hope that they bring the poems with the menus because that way you could talk about it over your meal rather than with the bill, although I suppose it makes the bill go down a little bit easier.
Yeah, but it's kind of like poetry is the after-dinner mint rather than poetry is the appetizer.
The main course. I think Max would agree with me on that.
Exactly. And I haven't met Liam, but I've seen some of the program, especially the Poetry Everywhere program. I think it's wonderful.
So I think we need a new word for this. I love the concept of reading local. So if you eat local, you're called a locavore, right? But what are you if you read local?
Oh, that's a good – I mean
– Local lex?
Local lex?
Could be. We'll work on that.
Local lect, maybe it would be.
An enlightened mind, how we go with that.
There you go. Well, Liam, you also created another local poetry project, Poetry Everywhere, and this was the project that put animated poetry videos on Milwaukee City buses.
Yeah, actually, and not just Milwaukee City buses, but there were cities nationwide that had transit screens, had video screens located in the buses themselves. And I was riding the bus one day, like a good writer, and I noticed that the mix of programming on the bus was mostly quiz shows and kind of trivia things. And I thought some poetry would look good up there. And my initial idea had been that we would just get some poets to stand in front of a microphone and a curtain, kind of Johnny Carson monologue style. But then some wiser minds that I teamed up with, Brad Lichtenstein at 371 Productions and his producer Jenny Plevin and animation professor Tim Decker, all at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, helped me envision this idea where we would bring students and poets together. So we had student animators, and then we had poets from around the country, in fact, around the world. And they collaborated on these projects that put every word of every poem on screen. That was important to me. But then, so as during your commute, you could actually encounter a few poems on the way. And it was just, it was a wonderful, wonderful project. And they still live on, so you can get them on iTunes and YouTube and things like that. But well, it seemed to, go ahead.
I was going to say, here, we've got a few with us. Let's play one of them right here. This is Winter by Robert Hayden.
Those Winter Sundays by Robert Hayden. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor and the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices?
I love that. That's just beautiful. It would take a daily commute to a whole different level, I think.
That was definitely my hope. And I think one of the things when I hope people do visit that online, when you can see it visually, the interesting thing that the animator did there, which was not to just put the words on the screen, but and not to just illustrate the story of the poem, but when, for example, that line, the chronic angers of that house, there are these two crossing planes of color, which look like they're going to collide, but then as they overlap, create a new color. And it was just a wonderful way of kind of extending that notion of the poem. I think for too long we've thought that, you know, if you were going from the page to the screen, that was only the path that fiction could take. But I think poetry could absolutely take that too. The whole idea of all these programs is to get poetry out of the ivory tower and out into the streets. And I know that that's something that Max is celebrated for too. I was just looking at a citation from the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences and seeing that he reaches out to those who may feel alienated from the world of poetry by promoting the connection between poetry and place. And I couldn't endorse that more. I think it's a wonderful thing. I think there's more poetry in people's daily lives than they realize.
Yeah, Max, I was going to ask you about that because it occurred to me that, you know, it's interesting. There's no National Fiction Month. it suggests that, you know, the truth is that there is something about poetry that people tend to find alienating. Why do you think that is?
That's interesting. Maybe they think fiction can take care of itself. I think that first of all, I wanted to say something about this project and the poem. I've seen the animation of the poem by Robert Hayden. It's very beautiful, and I think that's just the coolest project. I think it's a little bit of a misunderstanding of all the ways that poetry. It might be true to say that poetry or the concept of poetry seldom enters our minds, but often enters our lives. Hmm. And what I mean by that is I didn't know when I was sitting in Methodist and Baptist churches Sunday after Sunday and Wednesday night after Wednesday night that I was in the presence of poetry. I didn't know when I was trying to learn to sing harmony and hymns a third above that I was actually singing lines of poetry, but every time you're at a memorial service, every time you're at a wedding, an anniversary, a christening, any kind of religious service, every time you listen to a song that has a lyric in which the words and the rhythm sort of are bigger than the sum of their parts, you're in the presence of poetry. It's affecting you. It's rare to find a person not affected by the right words in the right order. Even, I would almost say that even when you can't find the words, the impulse to react to the world, to put into some sort of articulation, into some sort of words, what you see and feel at moments of your life. And they don't have to be tragic moments or spectacular moments, but small moments. It's rare to find a person who doesn't feel the urge to say something more than, what's up, how are you, fine, thanks. And that sometimes gets muted. Sometimes we learn how to obey the social conventions, but it doesn't go away. The impulse doesn't go away. And I would say even when it's not fully articulated, the urge is there, and that urge is where poetry comes from.
I'm curious, what would your definition of poetry be? What is poetry?
Well, I'm sure Liam has a lot of answers to that question, too. One definition that someone had is literally what I just said, the right words in the right order. The poet Ezra Pound has a pretty famous definition, which is literature is news that stays news. Oh. I just listened to the news here, and that news is already fading from my mind, as is yesterday's news and last week's. Sometimes we put words in an order, and they capture so much that they stay. They remain in our minds. I suppose one easy way to relate to that would be the awareness of pieces of songs, of lyrics of songs that have stayed with us we cannot shake. Sometimes even if we want to shake them, we can't. But they remain, and within those lyrics, within that rhythm, the emotion also is captured. The time is captured. And so I think that I could, you know, whole books are written defining poetry, but news that stays news is actually a poetic rendering, which is stuck in my mind for a long time.
Liam, I'm curious what you'd add to this, because interestingly, you're a fiction writer, a novelist, not a poet. So for you, what's the difference?
I think that poetry, there's a definition that stuck in my mind from my freshman high school English teacher, which was that poetry was saying the most in the fewest words possible. And I feel like, I'm not sure if all fiction writers aspire to it, but I do, in the sense that I really want to always try and condense my fiction down to so that I'm just saying the essential thing. And I always feel like if I just worked hard enough, someday I would get to a poem. But I haven't reached that level of transcendence yet. But I think poetry packs more per ounce than any other form of writing, and that's what I celebrate it for. And just to pick up on that notion of news, one of my favorite quotes, I'll bring in William Carlos Williams' definition. Well, I'm not sure if it's quite his definition, but his famous line that it's difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. And I think that's my idea of, like, that's why we need poetry in our daily life. But as Max pointed out, it is already there in our daily life. And I think, if anything, the idea that we don't segregate it off, I think sometimes when people hear poetry with a capital P, we all kind of sit and clasp our hands and as though we are back in church. And I think the great thing that I see actually happening in poetry today is that it's overspilling the bounds of National Poetry Month. It's everywhere.
And I would like to add one other thing to that. The not-so-dirty little secret is that a lot of people have poems stashed away in drawers, in journals, in computer files, a lot of people who you would not expect to do so. And once you start asking, once you start talking in front of people and talking to them after a reading or something like that, you find that out. You find that people who you would not expect have often felt this urge. They might not have revealed it. They might never reveal it. But there's more poetry in the closeted American life than you would think.
Well, there's a shout-out right waiting to happen right there. I would love to hear from other poets in this hour. Are you someone who secretly or not so secretly scribbles poetry? And perhaps there's something you've written that you would like to share. We can sort of do a little open mic time here. Short poems of 1 minute or less, please. But you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send us email. The address is talk@wpr.org. And let's hear another of the Poetry Everywhere poems.
Hedgehog. The snail moves like a hovercraft, held up by a rubber cushion of itself, sharing its secret with the hedgehog. The hedgehog shares its secret with no one. We say, hedgehog, come out of yourself and we will love you. We mean no harm. We want only to listen to what you have to say. We want your answers to our questions. The hedgehog gives nothing away, keeping itself to itself. We wonder what a hedgehog has to hide, why it so distrusts. We forget the God under this crown of thorns. We forget that never again will a God trust in the world.
That was Hedgehog by the poet Paul Muldoon. I'm Anne Strangechamps. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about poetry this hour with Wisconsin's new poet laureate, Max Garland, and with Milwaukee writer and English professor Liam Callanan. I'm curious, Max and Liam, both of you, I know, really believe in, I don't want to say poetry belonging to the people, but in the importance of poetry being a bigger, more acknowledged part of our daily life. Do you think, well, Max, you've said that you think everybody writes poetry, or many, many people do. And I was thinking, you know, the desire to preserve something of our lives, to leave a record, write something down, is just so universal. And I think it's why so many people keep journals, or they write memoirs or family history. Is there something different about approaching your life experience through a poem?
I think that we recognize, whether we think of ourselves as poets, whether we've ever finished or shown anyone else a poem, I think we recognize that what we reveal to other people through the language of our daily lives, even those close to us, is not all that we are. I think that we realize that there are parts of us that are meaningful parts, that are essential parts, that often don't get revealed. I think one of the things that literature, and particularly poetry, has been around for thousands of years for, is that it allows once in a while, either when we're reading or listening to a poem or when we're trying to put our words into poetry, it allows that part of us to be articulated. It allows us to remind each other we're not alone in those strange thoughts and fears, those little moments of wonder that we have, those questionings that we have, that we're not strange and isolated in those. And when you read, sometimes you realize, oh, somebody else felt that, somebody else thought that. And poetry, you know, is a very compressed way of doing that. It makes a little more use of rhythm and music, or a little more concentrated use, which also is helping convey intangible things like emotion and feeling. And so I think that's probably where the impulse comes from. I'd also like to say just briefly, right now in human history, we've never had as much language coming at us, as many images, as many multiple messages coming at us. Anytime we look at any screen, my students walk around with headphones in their faces, looking down at other smaller screens, you know, communicating with their thumbs. And I wonder if even now, all of the language coming at us, much too much language to even process, all of it meant to be disposable almost instantaneously, almost promotes a kind of shutting down. We have to shut down things. If you look at a television screen and you see something scrolling at the bottom, you see a talking head in a small a window at the top, and then there's other, you know, dire warnings at the side in language. I think that it's somewhat overwhelming. And I almost would make the case that poetry, instead of being a more rarefied form, an endangered form, it is more needed than ever.
That's so interesting. It makes me think of Walter Hamady, Wisconsin's great book artist, I remember said to me once, the more machine, the more hand. In other words, the more we surround ourselves with mass-produced items, the more we crave the handmade and the one-of-a-kind. So maybe the same thing's going on with language and poetry. You know, that if the volume of information we're dealing with every day has exploded, maybe conversely what we crave is a slower, deeper kind of language. Liam, does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does, and it actually reminds me, just before the break, we heard Paul Muldoon's poem Hedgehog, and one of the wonderful side benefits as a teacher for this experience of the Poetry Everywhere Project was that these students really had to bear witness. I mean, they had to spend a lot of time. Even though the films are fairly short, like two and a half minutes, it took an entire semester to put them together. And so the students had to sweat every single word. And so they really started to live these poems. And it was such a wonderful experience, I think, that it almost made me want to always teach poetry that way. But it's interesting because in that moment of stillness or that moment of compression that Max was just talking about, I remember the animator who worked on Paul Muldoon's poem, which is this beautiful kind of, it's a oil painting and there's a snail sliding across it. She wound up buying a hedgehog.
You're kidding.
And adopting it as a pet, which then totally tore apart her little student apartment. And apparently keeping a hedgehog is not really advisable. But I just love the idea that, you know, this poem had gotten into her DNA,
right.
And it made her react to the world. And I think that's just an extraordinary way to do it. And on that point that Max was also talking about, that you had mentioned earlier about that people have poems in the back of their minds, we found that definitely the case when we extended this program and in a next iteration and went up to the John Michael Kohler Art Center in Sheboygan, and we had a community-oriented Poetry Everywhere project where we brought just people in from the community from various communities up there in Sheboygan who weren't necessarily poets, but we brought them through poetry workshops, and then we brought in some other folks as animators. And they just created these wonderful things, just kind of speaking out of their own experiences of the things that they were seeing, the things that they were living. And to have them organize their thoughts and feelings that way, I thought was, if not just an instructive experience for them, it was an amazingly powerful experience for me.
Yeah. Well, we've got people who are calling with poems, so it's working. Let's go to, I think we've got Betsy on the line from River Falls. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. It's a delight to talk to all three of you, I must say. I'm a poet, and I have published one poem. I'm a hospice volunteer, and I wrote a poem about one of my clients with permission of the family and had it published because it was an amazing little boy. But the poem that I want to recite to you is very, very short, but I like it quite a lot. It's Slow Flow of Crow, Ballet in Black, because I like crows quite a lot.
Boy, you've got an ear for the musicality of language. Slow Flow of Crow. Then what's the second line?
Ballet in Black.
Ballet in Black. That's lovely.
Thank you for letting me share.
Oh, thank you for calling. That's Liam and Max, that's one of the things I think we haven't really talked about, but poetry is, I think, also helps us hear the beauty, the musicality in our language. You know, all those internal rhyme schemes and just the beauty of a phoneme.
Absolutely. It awakens us to the possibility of language, and it's something that I teach. I teach fiction writing, but it's something that I always try and remind, honestly, students even doing their critical papers in academic writing, to pay attention to how sentences are constructed, because even when it's just something you read on the page, I'd argue that your mind is hearing them. And for those words to kind of move through in a more musical way makes it a more powerful experience for the reader.
I think that's true, too. I think the wonder of language is something that we recognize as a child. It's why children are excited when they hear interesting language, even language that doesn't exactly make sense to them. There's a certain delight in it. And since language is what we use in our daily lives for sometimes more mundane and ephemeral purposes, I think we forget that language knows more than we do.
Mm.
That language has been a long time in coming. And sometimes when you're writing, it's, I think most poets, I think a lot of fiction writers think this too, it's not as if here are these things that in your head and you have to translate them to paper. But as you're writing, the language also leads you along. I mean, it's been handed down from long, long before there were alphabets, or long before there was printing, and that language sometimes will lend you a little help.
Max, is there? I was going to say, Max, is there? Did you bring any poetry with you?
Yes, I have. I have some.
Would you read something for us?
Okay, I don't have a hedgehog poem. I was trying to think what's the closest I have. It's about a squirrel. It's got a very high-toned title, Sciurus carolinensis, but that's basically a gray squirrel. I don't know why I gave it the scientific name. Squirrels, to me, are quite audacious. We tend to think of them as nuisances when they're robbing our feeders and you know, stealing their way into our attics. But I tried to remind myself that we learn from even these somewhat annoying animals. This is about a gray squirrel. It's hopeless how she loves this life. The gray squirrel digs a small moon's worth of craters in the yard. Some she fills, some leaves open. I've seen her work a walnut, still green, round and round, shaving the surface down to the meat. It moves in her claws like a planet or a bead, bigger and quicker than worry. By love, I mean she uses the day down to the last morsel of light, digs, barks, insults the crow, wheels and lashes her tail like a glorified whip. There's a charge in her, wild volts, a livid motion leaping from red pine to hackberry, the single forepaw catching first, swinging under, then over, then onto the branch. She's a circus when she takes to the power lines, racing the live wire above the lowly addresses. She's a spiral of serious sleep in the high hollow of the pin oak. By love, I mean filling herself with small right intentions. By life, I mean she looks at you from the railings. A kind of dare is in her, her tail curled like a bass clef or mutant fern. You won't catch her. She's scrolling from scent to sound to slightest motion. However the light moves might be ruin or rich enough to rob. The way she ransacks, hoards, loses, lashes, bluffs the crouched cat, the unleashed dog, her death, a dozen times a day, is what I mean by hopeless how she loves this life.
Oh, God, that's gorgeous. Oh, that's beautiful. And you made language that's like the squirrel. Your language dances about, and your language is a circus for a little bit.
Well, one could do worse than imitate a squirrel in its persistence and audacity.
But that's the other thing I really love. It seems to me a characteristic of wonderful poetry is you start with something so concrete. It's the falling in love with the concreteness, you know, the particularity of one squirrel or a particular moment, but then finding inside that something so universal.
It's those details, I think, that really, I mean, for example, in that the red pine to the hackberry, that's not just a tree to a berry. I mean, to bring us into it, and then I'm there with that squirrel, and like you, my heart was beating along with it. So I'm very worried about that squirrel now. Which is something I have to confess. I have not been worried about squirrels before, but it's involving and very moving in a very human way. Actually, just the other night, I was at the Medical College of Wisconsin talking with some physicians for Medical Humanities Project, and we were talking about some poems, and we were talking about how this is part of what makes us human. And it's interesting to talk about a poem about a hedgehog and a squirrel making us feel more human, but I feel like that's exactly what it's about.
Mm. Let's hear another poem from a listener. We've got Joan on the line from Williams Bay. Hi, Joan.
Hi, how are you?
We're okay. How are you?
Good. I have...
Can you turn your radio down in the background?
Oh, certainly. I forgot it was on here.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay. I have two short poems. The second one is four lines. The first one is maybe five.
Okay.
I would hope to read both of them.
Go ahead.
Health declines, old age is everywhere, wants to be seen and heard, not silenced, and children want their voices heard. The second one is ever seeking, never finding, for I know not what I seek, plaintive yearning, my heart binding by the things I wish to teach.
Mm-hmm. Joan, when do you write poetry? Is it something you've done all your life, or something you've started doing recently?
No, actually, I think as I'm looking back, I might have done it all my life. I just jot it down when I get the mood or feeling something strikes me, something I hear, just to jot down my thought. And then it just gets squirreled away talking about squirrels.
It sounds like you have young people around you in your life, too. Is this something, is the poetry scribbling something you passed on to your children?
No, I don't. This is just a toy, my own toy.
Okay.
I really should treat it a little better.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome.
And we've got another caller. I think this is Ronnie Hess in Madison. Now, Ronnie is a published poet and also one of the key people involved with the Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets. Hi, Ronnie. Are you there?
Yes, I am here. Can you hear me too?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, and I also should mention that I'm one of the members of the Poet Laureate Commission, and so we were very delighted to choose Max. Max was in Appleton this past weekend for the Fox Cities book festival, and just before Max, there was a tribute for Ellen Court, who was the first poet laureate of Wisconsin, and in Verse Wisconsin, which is a wonderful publication that I encourage everybody to subscribe to, there was a series of poems for Ellen Court, edited by Fabu, former Madison Poet Laureate. And I think that this is in the spirit of what Max was talking about earlier in the program. This is part of a poem by Marilyn Zelke Window from Sheboygan Falls. And she credits Ellen with having helped her become a poet, just as Max is today. It had been enough until her beckoning, a lifetime of words, kept in notebooks, on ruled paper, three-ring binders, cardboard separated from high school, from college, from marriage, births of three daughters, career, holidays, caregiving, death, all in a drawer, shut from others' eyes. You can, you have, you should, you will. She filled my cup, encouraged me to refill it with words, with emotion, with stories, with life to share.
Hmm.
And if you'll just permit me, I wanted to add to the wonderful work that Liam is doing in Milwaukee. Shoshana Shai, who has something called Poetry Jumps Off the Shelf, is also putting poetry in public places. There's a new book coming out called Echo Locations, a new collection of poems about Madison. Cycle bikes, B-cycle bikes, which have decals emblazoned with poems. Haikus on the marquee of the Fox Theater in Stevens Point has been encouraged by her. There's a community mural project in Bailey's Harbor, which will include part of Laureen Niedecker's poem, Wintergreen Ridge.
Wow.
There's some great, great stuff happening around the state. And I also want to mention Carl Gartung and Ann Kingsbury, their Woodland Pattern bookstore in Milwaukee, which has shaped the lives of generations now of poets, and who back in 1979 started something which got me invested in poetry, which was Dial a Poem. Mm-hmm. You could pick up your phone and dial a poem. It was just absolutely terrific. So I want to thank all of you, all of these contributors over my mature lifetime to poetry in Wisconsin.
Thanks for calling, Ronnie. It was great to hear from you. I love that image of just poetry practically spilling over the cup throughout Wisconsin. It just seems like there's so much of it these days. So listen, if you would like to join our conversation, are you a poet? And in particular, and when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Max, I want to pick up on something you were talking about, which is poetry and sense of place. So if there is, perhaps you're listening and there's a poem or a few lines of a poem that has really captured for you a particular place, call and join the conversation, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, talk@wpr.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Incision. The nape of my neck is a tell. Otherwise, you wouldn't notice, with the layers of clothes, shirt, vest, scarf, coat. Undressed, it's a solitary hole in the middle of a white wall. You can't help but stare. What picture hung there? What of? What color? It gets worse than this. You'll want to see how far down it goes. The circular incision, top and bottom, a line contained by points. The seal of an envelope, opened.
That was Incision by Gillian Weiss. It's another one of those Poetry Everywhere poems. We're talking with Wisconsin's poet laureate Max Garland today and writer and UWM professor Liam Callanan. This morning we're talking about poetry, and I wanted to get back to talking about sense of place, because I think, well, Max, I know you were saying that that's, for you, you're really interested in talking about and promoting the connection between poetry and place. What is that connection?
Yes, yeah, I suppose this is a parallel to what I was talking about earlier with the electronic babble coming at us constantly, and how do we sort it out without shutting down, you know, the receptors to things that are meaningful. I think we have currently the most almost unimaginable mapping equipment. You can see on a handheld device your front yard. You can find places by entering the address, and it is amazing what the satellites tell us. And yet, we are no closer to knowing what it's like to live in any of those places that we can so easily electronically locate now. And I think sometimes there might be an illusion that we know a place because we can find it now through electronic means. The mapping is very sophisticated, but the mapping is not complete unless it tells you what it's like for a person to live there, what they feel, what they remember, what they wonder about, what they fear, what they love. And I think that kind of mapping doesn't show up on the Chamber of Commerce site. It doesn't show up in the demographics. It doesn't show up in the job numbers. It doesn't show up on Google Earth. But poetry is one of those ways in which we can say who we are when we live in a place.
Liam, does that speak to you, the concept of the poetry as a way of mapping a place?
Absolutely. And I think that that's one of the things that maps trick us into thinking that by reading a map, we know a place, or for that matter, we know where we're going, when there's so many more layers that are not even can be present on that map. And that's something that a poem can do. I mean, even a poem like we just heard, Gillian Weiss's Incision, talks about, you know, the map of the body and the what a scar leads us to. And I'm thinking of two other of the Poetry Everywhere poems, Lucille Clifton's Mulberry Fields, or for that matter, Martina Spada's En la Calle San Sebastián. In that latter poem, that was a woman from, the student animator there was animating this poem, and she was just learning English because she was visiting UWM from Hong Kong. And so the idea that she could wrestle with the sense of place that Martina Spada was bringing her to just with his words in a language that she was just learning, I think speaks directly to the nature of the endeavor.
Mm. We've got Ia on the line from Appleton next. Hi, Ia, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thanks for calling. Did you have something to share?
Well, I first want to share that I'm so happy to hear from Max. I missed his presentation at the Appleton Book Festival, but I am a former Central Fox Valley Regional Vice President of the Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets, and I was that for 4 years and enjoyed it very much. And I do have a poem. It's called Weep for the Trees. Weep for the trees, for they do not stand a chance in all this insane environment of urban sprawl. Weep for the trees, for they do not stand a chance when your neighbor hideously chops them down because they are an imperfection on the face of his immaculately groomed lawn. Weep for the trees, for they do not stand a chance as Northwest loggers continue their selfish, gluttonous clear-cutting. Weep for the trees, for they do not stand a chance to be habitat for all creatures great and small. Weep for the trees, for they do not stand a chance to be cool shade for children who play hardy under the torrid sky. Weep for the trees, for they do not stand a chance to bend and sway in a breeze, their branches and leaves, meditative music to a daydreamer's ears. Weep for the trees, for they are gone.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for sharing that. Are there particular trees that...
Well, I live in a neighborhood who is cutting down trees happy, and I have my own little tree house when I look out my window where I live and see the beautiful trees that are still standing and hope that they will never be taken down eventually. But I just want to say that I led the open mic at Harmony Cafe in Appleton for 6-7 years. I'm a former teacher, and I brought out a lot of young poets during that time, and enjoyed it immensely, to turn them on to poetry. And the idea of having that on, poetry on the bus was something I had in mind back then, you know, a few years ago. So great minds think a lot alike. Mm-hmm.
Well,
and I'm so happy to hear that this is occurring.
Great. Well, thank you so much for calling. You know, I was thinking about place and poetry, and partly I'm thinking that it's such a long tradition in poetry, exploring the essence of a place. I was thinking about the British Romantic poets in particular, really forged that connection between the natural world and poetry. I mean, wasn't Wordsworth, didn't some of the poets like Wordsworth? I mean, first of all, Wordsworth, I know, wrote a lot of poems while walking, but I think poetry almost became a way of perceiving the natural world. I don't know which of you can speak to that most. Who knows most about Wordsworth?
Well, I'm sure Liam could speak to it as well. I think that Wordsworth and the other Romantic poets tried to draw an inspiration from a nature that was fast changing in front of them as the Industrial Revolution, as the sort of depopulation of the countryside was progressing in Wordsworth's time. It occurred to him and the other poets who later became called Romantics that that world was to be valued, and as a matter of fact, that it was in fact divine, and that we could learn from that, that we were part of that. It kind of counterbalanced the idea that the natural world was to be exploited and used only for human consumption. And that in that destruction, anything that we are on the verge of losing, you know, someone will often find the value of. And so Wordsworth drew his inspiration from that and helped remind us, as a matter of fact, as did Thoreau and Whitman and Robert Burns in Scotland, that the natural world is where we come from. It's what we're connected to. As the last caller was implying, you know, that tree is a part of what Aldo Leopold would have called the biotic community. And we can't think of ourselves in terms of merely human communities because we are made of that larger community, that natural world.
Mm. Liam, anything to add?
I was just going to say, when I think of this topic, too, thinking closer to home, I think of Loren Nedeker, who is, I think, one of Wisconsin's most famous poets of place and was born on Black Hawk Island, and that's also where her life ended, at the end of a very full and busy life, but one of Wisconsin's best-known poets. And just the way that she brought that world to life, not, you know, not extraordinary like the Grand Canyon or the Alps or anything like that, but just to kind of unfold the beauty of that place, I think is kind of uncovers the magic of what's possible. And we went out actually with a group of students a few years ago to see the cottage where she lived. And I highly recommend going to visit the museum they have there in Fort Atkinson as well. And just to see that poet's sense of place come alive in front of her eyes was really a magical experience.
Mm, thank you so much. Thank you both so much for being with us today. This has just been a pleasure. And Max, is there perhaps a short poem you could take us out with?
Well, speaking of place, speaking of Wisconsin, I will read a very recent poem. We've had about 3 snowstorms in Eau Claire within the last 2 weeks or so. And so today we have what appears to be, the best I can tell, a spring day. But this is a poem I wrote a week or so ago called Spring Snow. Many people in Wisconsin actually have had this experience recently. Spring Snow. I guess the snow must love us deeply. Smack in the heart of April, the sharp flakes fall. The branches can't catch them. The snow plows grow sullen. The warblers are stalled 600 miles to the south, waiting for rumors of green in the wind. Half of the waters here are open. Half are a white waste where mallards brood and crows rehash their guttural alphabets. The snow must believe there's never enough. Whatever we lack, the sky can deliver. Loving not wisely, but a little too well. Snow pierces the air like so many pale tattoos. You can't remember why you coveted such flakes as a child. Held out your arms, unfurled your tongue. Now all you feel is the bite of spring snow falling out of love, I guess.
Liam, thank you. I mean, Max, thank you so much. And thank you both for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to join this conversation.
Great. Liam Callanan is a professor of English and a writer at the UW-Milwaukee, and Max Garland is the poet laureate of Wisconsin. And while we're on the subject of poetry, it's good to remember that poets are everywhere. For instance, I recently met a young man. He's not that long out of high school himself. He didn't grow up reading poetry, but to me, he's kind of a living example of how poetry can save lives.
I am Stephen John Rodriguez. I am a junior here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I came in through First Wave Urban Arts and Hip Hop Scholarship Program. Basically, this is a piece called Little Man. It's based on just a lot of the struggles that my little brother has been enduring, and how I've also had to like understand that process that he's going through, just so I could be a better big brother for him. There's gotta be something better, man. There's gotta be something different. There's gotta be something better, man. There's gotta be something different. There's gotta be something better, man. There's gotta be something different. There's gotta be something different. There's gotta be something different. I would like to dedicate this to my little brother, Justin Vallejo. I feel like I've been losing him. After talking with him, he just told me, "Look, Steven, you can never understand the things that I be going through. When there ain't nobody at school who is close to you. I mean, what am I supposed to do? These kids is calling me a bitch, telling me my face looks retarded as shit. I hit him hard in his ribs and straight stuck him in his jaw, but they arrested me. See, I don't trust these teachers at all because they're just like police, the kind that kick down our doors. While you were in college, they threw our mom to the floor. It feels like I'm living in war, Steven. I can't take it. I was given this world. I didn't make it." Justin, he's my youngest brother. He's had a lot of struggle, a lot. Growing up, like, our mom, she's a cocaine addict. And his dad has always been, like, an abusive man. Like, he would just, like, hit us, and, like, we'd watch him hit our mom. And it's just that all builds up. It's all the historical context of who he is, who I am, and who we are as a family. They say that public schools are pipeline to prisons. And that crack-addicted mother's our puff-puff pipeline to infants. My brother was born with the tumor. The first things that I did when I was like 11 years old, I would just, like, question, you know, like, why my family was in the position that my family was in. You know, like, how come we're poor? How come we're not, like, the families on TV? How come I don't know who my real dad is? How come I watch my mom get beaten? How come this all exists in the household that's supposed to be safe? And I guess, like, the only way that that was able to funnel out of me in a non-negative way was through hip-hop. So I tried to tell him, "Little man, you gotta understand, America wouldn't lose a dream if they couldn't find you. This country might not give a damn, but I do. Because, little man, you're my little brother. I'm sorry I can't be there, but you need to think about the struggle. Police won't see a kid if you're out in these streets. I mean, little man. You're taller than me, so what they'll outwardly see is another Mexican man. And that might get you more than handcuffed and forced to step in a van. You gotta be intelligent and understand the world we live in. Corporations make decisions based on how many of us can fit in a privatized prison." And hip-hop is one of the very few art forms in mainstream media where the people who are speaking speak like me, they look like me, they talk like me. It's people who I feel like could have been from my community, and that builds a certain hope within you. Even if that hope is distant, it's still there. And I mean, when hope is scarce, you cling on to that. There's gotta be something better, man. There's gotta be something different. There's gotta be something better, man. There's gotta be something different. There's gotta be something better, man. There's gotta be something different. There's gotta be something different. There's gotta be something different.
Stephen Rodriguez is a student in the UW-Madison's First Wave Hip Hop and Urban Arts program. I think it's the only undergraduate hip hop program in the country. You know, there's always more than we can possibly get to. So quick shout out to our Facebook page, 45 North on WPR. We'll post some of those animated poetry videos there that we were talking about, so you can see them there. Also links to Max Garland's volumes of poetry. Speaking of books, I wanted to let you know that we are starting a book club here on 45 North. It's called 45 North Reads, and our first selection is Benjamin Percy's new novel, Red Moon. It's a politically charged literary werewolf story. You can kind of think George Orwell crossed with werewolves. And you can read or listen to an excerpt of it on our Facebook page. Our first book club meeting will be Friday, May 10th at 9 a.m. right here on the radio, 45 North on WPR.
Millie befriended a stranded star whose rays five languid fingers were